Hello, and welcome to Travel Fun. My name is Mary Beth Clementi, and this is a special tribute program to Sharon Schuterin, beloved Telluride resident and traveler extraordinaire. Sharon and I had the opportunity to talk about travels many, many times, and she was as comfortable traveling in Paris, that's how we originally connected, as she was in Bhutan. And I had the pleasure of interviewing her three times on this Travel Fun program. And the following, you will hear parts of two of those interviews. And I will also be posting this on my blog, bonjourcolorado.com, as a podcast in case you want to listen to it again. So sit back, listen, let Sharon inspire you, feel her passion, her love for travel, people, places, and all of mankind. Welcome, Sharon.
Thanks for inviting me, Mary Beth.
It's good to have you here.
I think the last time was Bhutan.
Bhutan, another exotic place. Is there a welcome that you can say in either Cambodian, Vietnamese, or Thai?
Well, I can. It's just that I will probably pronounce it incorrectly. What I did learn that my best was because I was in Vietnam during Tet, which is their New Year's. Chung Mung Nam Mui, which means Happy New Year in Vietnamese.
Wow, that's ambitious.
But they, of course, laughed at my accent, so.
Right. Well, let's talk about the language thing. I didn't mean to jump in there, but already this is a part of the world I have never been to, Southeast Asia, and it seems so fascinating and exotic, and I do want to go there someday, but it also seems like, well, how does a person fare there without speaking the language? And just with so many vast cultural differences, I imagine you encountered. So if you talk a little bit about that at first, that would be interesting.
Sure. I'm a lot like you, Mary Beth. I've traveled in all over Europe by myself. I've traveled in a lot of different places, but basically in Asia, I had traveled to Bhutan, I'd been through Bangkok, and I traveled to Bali, which is Southeast Asia. So I really hadn't been there, so I really didn't know what to expect. I have to say that it's probably very different now than what it was for those people that went to India and Southeast Asia, you know, 20, 30 years ago even. It has become very touristy, and so it is not as difficult as you would think it would be. There are many, many people that speak English, especially in Vietnam. Cambodia, all the tour guides speak English. The average person doesn't necessarily speak English, but it really isn't as difficult as you'd think. And one of the things that I do, and I'm sure you probably do it in other cultures too, is no matter where I go, I try to learn those magic six or seven phrases,
right,
which most of us who travel
phrases
do. You know, hello, goodbye, please, thank you, where's the toilet? You know, just the basics. And the one that I learned in Vietnam that worked the best is when the tuk-tuk drivers would come and say, you know, need a ride, do you need a ride? And you say, no thank you. Or say it in Vietnamese, no thank you. And they keep bugging you. I finally had my Vietnamese friends teach me how to say, I'm walking. So I would say, Thuy Li Bo, which I, again, am probably not pronouncing correctly, but they got it. They would follow me, and I turn around and say, Thuy Li Bo, and they would say, oh, and turn around and leave.
And that made all the difference.
Made all the difference because I wasn't, you know, I was just saying, I'm just walking.
Right. What is a tuk-tuk?
Well, what you find in Asia, all over Southeast Asia, is various forms of transportation. Some places, there's lots of cars, and then there are the Seclos and the tuk-tuks and those things. But in Vietnam, at least the places we were, which were Hue and Hoi An, there are more bicycles, motorbikes, and Seclos, and some tuk-tuks, and then tuk-tuks in Cambodia, and also in Thailand. I'll sort of start with the Seclos are bicycles that have a little seat on the front, and so obviously sort of like a rickshaw, except instead of being pulled, they're pushed. Tuk-tuks range from ones, I did actually see some with bicycles, some have almost like a little motorcycle on the front, and then they have a little surrey with a fringe on top on the back, and the various owners decorate them in whatever they want, and so they can be very plain or they can be more fanciful, you know, based on the owner's preferences.
So it sounds as though they're all some sort of descendants of the rickshaw.
Yeah.
Okay. We've got that.
Man or woman. Actually, I didn't see any women tuk-tuk drivers, so I shouldn't say that. But person-powered, again, either by bicycle, so under their own force, or with a motorbike.
Okay. So, Sharon, you visited Cambodia, Vietnam, and Thailand.
Yep.
In three and a half weeks. Tell us about the whole planning process, how you chose those countries, and how you decided to organize your trip, because that's always an important part of one's travels.
Yeah. I would say that if I had to do it over again, you know, one, I wish I'd had at least 3 months, 2 months minimum, and I probably would have done at least 3 weeks minimally, and absolute minimally, in each country. Having said that, as you mentioned, I'm the judge, so I can only fudge so much. Even after all this time, I still have to come back and work. So 3.5 weeks is about the most that I can get off. In terms of how I chose those particular places, I was meeting someone in Bangkok, which is sort of the central place to fly into, because that's where you can get the best fares, and it's also the point from which you can get easily to any place else. And Vietnam was because I've always wanted to go to Vietnam, but we also had, last summer, the Global Mountain Theater from Telluride Academy brought the Vietnamese kids who'd been involved in Mudbutts the year before. And so I met all the Vietnamese kids last summer and got to know them, and they all encouraged me to come over and visit, and even further encouraged me to come during Tet, which is very interesting because some people say don't go to Vietnam during Tet. Everything's closed down. It's like going to New York City in the middle of, you know, Thanksgiving, Christmas, or New Year's. You know, everybody's with their families. It's all closed down. I found it to be wonderful, and I was visiting friends. So, and I was totally taken in and included in family events for Tet, which is...
And those are the New Year's celebrations.
Yes. So that's, you know, that's an unusual circumstance. I you know, went to the fireworks with their family. I was the honored first guest of Tet.
Oh, that must have been really special.
And if you remind me later in the show, I have a great story about that.
Well, tell us now.
Okay. Well, one of the traditions of Tet is that whoever is the first person to come over your doorstep or come to your house after midnight or sometime in the day of Tet is considered the honored first guest. And you're supposed to leave it up to luck and hope that you get a good guest and it's an honored person and a good person and that person will bring you luck for the whole year. Well, my friends, Dot and his family, I was specifically requested to be the honored first guest. And his mother, there's another tradition of Tet, which is that you have to wear new clothes. Well, Dot told me this a week before, and I'm in Telluride, and I'm going to relatively warm Vietnam, with new thinking, where in the world, what am I going to get to take there? Well, the next email I got was, Sharon, I need all your measurements of your whole body, including the rounds on your chest. His mother had an áo dài made for me, which is, for those of you who don't know, the traditional Vietnamese outfit. It is loose-fitting pants in silk with the, it's almost looks like an overblouse with long slits down the sides with long sleeves and a high neck. So his mother had you know, made me the Ao Yai, and I was their honored first guest. Well, we went to see the fireworks at his uncle's house. So I, of course, became, because the fireworks ended after midnight, I was the honored first guest also at his uncle's house. And he told me the day after that that his uncle had already had good luck, so I'd already brought them luck. But the story was that on the day of Tet, everyone goes to be with their family. And so all my Vietnamese friends were visiting family, and so we were on our own. So we were walking to the citadel, and along the water, the sort of the moat and the water, we looked up, and in one of the houses, they're all sort of people's homes, but they have their doors open. There was this older couple, and when I say older, as it turns out, I think he told us he was 90 something, and she was at least 88, standing in their doorway, and he begins to speak French to me. Well, unfortunately, he had no teeth, and his accent was very difficult to understand, but we tried to at least communicate in French a little bit, and they invited us, and we weren't sure quite why until afterward. They invited us into their home, and they were completely dolled up, I mean totally dressed to the max. He had a suit on, she had a beautiful dress on, and as I said, he told us he was either 90 or 92, and she was 88, and they brought us into the, you know, just the room, and sat us down and gave us tea and gave us all the traditional sweets and the kinds of things that it's candied ginger and these watermelon seeds that you eat and various things that are the traditional Tet things and talked to us and told us about their family, showed us the picture, and maybe for 20-30 minutes, and then it was sort of clear that it was time for us to leave, and we left. And when we left, I thought, well, that's really strange. Why did they out of the blue invite us into their house? And then I realized that they had probably been standing there looking down the street, that they hadn't had a guest for Tet. And they were looking for someone to invite in as their first guest of Tet. And invited us, and so we became also their guests, for first honored guests for Tet, because they thanked us and told us that.
Right.
So
that
it was great.
Like a
it was
wonderful
great
tradition.
Fun. It was great fun.
And just like this is a recurring theme on my show, how having a contact with the native people makes such a difference, whether it's just a chance encounter or friends that you're going to visit or whatever. It really makes all the difference in the world in a trip, and that sounds as though that was a really big highlight.
Absolutely.
For you.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm a big people person, so my theory is you can always watch it on a video if you need to. It's great to visit these places, but and it's not that I don't want to go see the places, but it's not about the places, it's about the people.
About the people.
It's totally about the, and even if you don't speak their language, you know, I had a wonderful encounter with a woman on the road from going from Siem Reap to Phnom Penh. We had to stop to use the restroom. Finally, you know, our driver didn't speak English, and we'd had a car. And finally, the person I was with said, "Toilet, madame!" And he pulled over in this town where it was just people just had their pots out in front. And the woman let me use the squat toilet. And I came out, and she saw my camera and points to her little girl and wanted me to take a picture of a little girl. So I took a picture. And of course, the kids started gathering around, so I started taking pictures of all the kids. And it was dusk, so it was really difficult to get good pictures. And this woman was absolutely gorgeous. I mean, the high cheekbones and beautiful Cambodian. And I'm taking all the pictures, and the kids are getting into it, and I'm communicating with her just by hand signals. And then I thought, aha, I have a picture of my son in my purse. I pulled out the picture of my son, and I pointed at her little one, pointed at her, pulled out the picture of Elliot, pointed at him, and pointed at me, and she burst into this huge smile. It was mothers communicating. You know, she knew just what I meant. But that, again, was one of the highlights. So it's, as you said, whether it's just meeting someone by chance or having contacts in places. And the wonderful thing about living in Telluride is before I left, I can't tell you, I had probably 7 advisors of people who had just been to the same areas I'd been to. There's, you know, a number of people in town who've lived over there. You know, Cindy, who owns Siam, lived both in Vietnam and has a house in Chiang Mai. Esther White, who used to live here, is here for a couple months in the summer, lives in Chiang Mai 10 months of the year. And whenever you mention it to someone, inevitably I had someone who said, oh, you're going there? I have a friend that lives there. Email them. And so I ended up connecting with people who were friends of friends. And almost everywhere we went, I had some connection of someone to give me, either give me advice or meet for a coffee. It was wonderful.
Well, we are going to take a very short break, and then we'll be right back to hear more about Sharon's trips to Southeast Asia. Welcome back to Travel Fun. I'm Mary Beth Clementi, and I am visiting here with Sharon Schuterin. And Sharon was recently in Southeast Asia for 3.5 weeks, and she traveled to Cambodia, Vietnam, and Thailand. And Sharon, I'm going to pose a real challenge to you. I'm going to ask you to just sum up in whether in just a couple of sentences or a handful of words, some of the impressions you had from each country, each of those three countries. Okay?
That's difficult, but Cambodia, I would say, might be the easiest to categorize in a sense, and that is that they are truly a testament to the resiliency of the human spirit. I have never seen bigger smiles on people's faces, kinder, gentler. And again, these are surface impressions. We were in Cambodia for 6 days, so someone could correct me and say, well, I lived there and it wasn't like that. But this is my impression. After what went on with the Khmer Rouge and the Cambodian Holocaust, the fact that 30 years later, 25 years later, these people have this still joie de vivre is absolutely amazing to me. The other impression of Cambodia is that tourism is, they've just come into their own with tourism in the last 6 to 8 years, and so it is growing immensely. And if you're going to go, I'd say go now, because it's changing rapidly. Siem Reap, they're building 5-star hotels on every corner. And they're beautifully designed, but they all look exactly alike. And to go into Angkor Wat at sunset is to mill through millions of people or zillions of people. So that's what I'd say about Cambodia, and it is a beautiful country. Vietnam, as I said, I have very different impressions because I was, my fondest memories are, you know, sitting side saddle on the back of a motorbike or on the back of Dot's bicycle, going down this, you know, in this mass of traffic, being the only Caucasian around. Because it was interesting, in Vietnam we didn't see very many Americans at all. Most of the Caucasians we saw were Europeans, and in Cambodia a lot of them were French. But Vietnam, the older people would often give you very interesting looks. You could tell that there was still some residual effects from the war. Although if you talk to a lot of Vietnamese, they say, you know, what do you mean the war? You were a blip on the radar screen. We've been invaded by everybody. So they don't see it in quite the same way we do. But the younger people love Americans, and they want to speak English to you, and they want to talk to you. They're beautiful people. Everyone always talks about Thai women. Well, the Vietnamese are gorgeous, just gorgeous. And the Cambodians are gorgeous because of their incredible smiles and because of that resiliency of spirit. Bangkok, most people's impression is traffic and pollution. And it does have a nicer side. I'm still looking for it. When I find it, I'll let you know. Although I think the best thing for me about Thailand is the food.
I was going to ask you about the food in all three of those countries.
The food's great in all of them. And I ate off the street. I didn't, because of the situation, I didn't eat off the street as much in Vietnam because it was Tet and more things were closed. Cambodia, the food's different, but it's excellent. It's a lot of French influence. Thailand, we all know. The food is fabulous, and I ate off the street and had some of the most amazing food I've ever eaten, and things that I never knew existed, you know, different fruits and vegetables and kinds of things that were just fabulous.
And you felt that it was okay, it was safe to eat from the vendors, the street vendors?
Well, Cindy DiVittorio gave me a hint, and she said, look at the dishes, and if there's a lot of soap, you think that means it's clean, but they don't rinse them well. And so a lot of people get sick from that more than the bug so much. I think it's from the soap and leaving the soap on the dishes. I never got sick in the entire time we were there. I will say I had once or twice when I went to the restroom rather quickly, shall we say, but it was once in a day. And so I was never sick. But I have a stomach of iron, so everyone has to kind of deal with their own. But I would say the food, one of the highlights is the food. And in fact, the person I was with said, you know, if I were coming back to Cambodia again, I think I might come just for a culinary tour, because the food really was excellent.
And I like the idea of those French influences.
Yes, you definitely would.
Om Save Sham Purnam Babatu, Save Sham Mangalam Babatu.
Hello, and welcome back to Travel Fun. I have a local, Sharon Schuterin, from Telluride, here in the studio. And Sharon has done a lot of service work for a number of years in far-flung countries. And she has organized many of her trips on her own. I would like to welcome Sharon Schuterin to Travel Fun. Hi, Sharon.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. So talk about how you first got involved in service travel.
Well, and I apologize for my voice. I have the Telluride crud a little bit, as everybody does, so forgive the fact that I sound like a frog. Actually, what happened was I had done a number of trips with the Mudbutts, and I ended up going with Telluride Academy to Bhutan back in 2004, and like everyone else, fell in love with Bhutan and said, I want to go back, but I don't want to go back as a tourist. I want to go back and give back. So I thought about programs dealing with alcoholism, dealing with domestic violence, all kinds of things, and was unable to really, you know, while still working full-time or, you know, on all my various things, to do that, and ended up coming in contact with Jeff and Becky Marsh, who Jeff is the medical director of the Bhutan Cleft Care Project. And it's a long story to explain how it came about, but let's suffice it to say that I ended up being invited to be the non-medical coordinator of the project. So that was sort of my first exposure And since 2007, I've been going and spending anywhere from 6 weeks to 2 months every year in Southeast Asia, Bhutan mainly, but Laos, Thailand, Cambodia, and Vietnam.
And that has been working with the Cleft Care Project?
The main focus has been, that was sort of the more organized, was the Cleft Care Project. And we go for approximately 2 weeks every year, and the doctors do cleft surgeries, and we do training with Bhutanese nurses and doctors. It's sort of the teach a man to fish kind of thing. We do the surgeries, but we also try and help them get up to speed so that they eventually will hopefully be able to do all their own work.
And what has your mission entailed?
The cleft mission?
Yes.
It is a cleft care project. So what it is to do cleft lip and cleft palate surgeries. And again, we have a Bhutanese doctor that we've been training and doing continuing education for, training the anesthetic nurses, some of the anesthesiologists, and various other recovery nurses, operating room nurses. And we usually do somewhere between 60 and 70 surgeries. The majority of those are cleft. We do always, last year we had a young woman, 18 years old, whose face had been mauled by a bear, and he basically tried to take her face off, and we've had burn victims. So I'd say we often have three or four where, based on the circumstances, because it's kind of an emergency, we take care of those kind of things, or we do repairs on them.
I guess I should be more precise in asking, what are your days like when you go and work on this project and
Well, I'll tell you, the Bhutan is a little bit different from the other project I worked on last year. But in Bhutan, we basically arrive in Paro. We have lunch and we get in a vehicle. And in Bhutan, it takes a long time to get anywhere because there's one road and it's very windy. We get to the next place, spend the night, which is near Wang Du Po Drong. And then we get up the next morning, drive to Trongsa, which is where the hospital that we're based out of. Load up all the things that we've left in the hotel the year before, and take them over to the hospital. The nurses start setting up. Literally, we have an operating room that has almost nothing in it. So we set up the entire operating room with things that we've left, things that are brought by the nurses and doctors from Thimphu, and then we do triage on the people that are the drop-ins to figure out who's going to get operated on when, etc. My day's a little different from everyone else's. We are at breakfast by 7. Most of us start walking over to the hospital, which is about a 45-minute walk. Some people take the bus. Bus meets us partway. We start doing surgeries usually by 8:30. And basically, the doctor's and the nurse's day is doing the surgeries and recovery room, etc. My day, because I'm non-medical, is that I help make sure the schedules, there's copy of the schedules for everyone. I interview every single family of every patient we have. So I have to triage and figure out when I can get them done. Takes about 45 minutes, sometimes longer if we have two or three languages we have to go through to do the interviews. I find the patients, so the nurses don't have to be running out to try and find the patients. I get them into the waiting area, make sure that they've got their records, make sure they're gowned, I'm sort of the gopher. I make sure that things are running on time so the doctors can do what they do, which is incredible surgery, and I try and take care of some of the other details.
And are you interacting with a number of other foreigners? Are you mostly with Bhutanese, or is there a mix of both?
Our project is international, so we have Americans, me, Jeff and Becky. We have a doctor out of Rochester, and for the last 2 years, he's brought a resident with him. And then we have Canadian anesthesiologists and some Canadian nurses, and we have a Swiss doctor who's retiring this year and won't be coming again. We have a German anesthesiologist. We've had an Israeli pediatric dentist who's come with us, and an Israeli nurse that's come first time last year. And then we have Indian speech therapists and pathologists. We have a Bhutanese doctor and then Bhutanese nurses and staff, basically, who are being trained or being given continuing medical education as to clefts. And then we have there's one Bhutanese speech therapist and one who's in a graduate program in India.
What has this experience meant to you?
People say this, and it always sounds so trite and so cliche to say, I get more out of it than I give. We work, last year was one of the harder years. We work probably a minimum of 10 hours a day, often 12. And we get back exhausted, and then we, you know, have dinner and quick try and fight over the computer, and then we go to sleep and we get up the next morning and do it again, and we have one day off in the middle. That said, just what I've learned from the people that we've been around, when I think I have the best job in the whole project because I get to talk to all the families. Some speak English, some it's through an interpreter, and I have a wonderful partner who is Bhutanese and speaks various languages, and he translates for me and works with me. But just these are people who've walked for half a day to a day with a baby on their back and a toddler by their side, to then be able to get on a bus and come for 3 days, to come to a hospital where there's one bed and four people in the family are sleeping on the bed. There's no books. There's no magazines. They cook their own food. Sometimes the hospital provides some food. We try and provide coloring books and toys for the kids. But they don't need to be entertained the way we do. And watching their patients and just the lengths that they will go for their children and for their family members is just amazing. And just getting outside of yourself, seeing a different culture, seeing that you can give back to someone else, and it's not all about you, and stretching your limits, really. I would highly recommend it to anyone who even has the slightest interest in it, because I think it really expands your horizons.
So it's not so much about taking in landscapes and different foods and that sort of thing, but having a feel for the way another people lives.
Absolutely, because we're in Trongsa for 10 to 12 days. We are staying in a hotel, but we go into town. We've made friends with the people at the hotel. We've got a connection. I feel like Trongsa is my other hometown. We walk to the hospital often or walk back from the hospital, so we meet people along the way. Most of the kids speak English, or they want to practice their English, so they always want to talk to us. And so there's a real connection. And I think that's one of the things about volunteer travel that is really different, is when you go someplace, it gives you a connection to a place. It's not just, even if you're going to go hang in a place for 2 weeks, if you're just hanging as a tourist, it's a very different situation than it is if you're working there. And I say that having spent time on the Thai-Burmese border this most recent trip for about 3 weeks, and I connected to TBBHI, Thai-Burma Border Health Initiative. And I connected with that because Peter Harrelson from here had worked with them, gone up and worked with them, and Sam McBride, who works as an ER doc at the clinic periodically, on a rotation and works at Indian Health Services, works with them. And so through them, I connected with this program. And it would have been a very different experience. The town I was in, Sanklapuri, is not much of a tourist town except for Thai tourists. You probably wouldn't go there for that. But it would have been a very different experience to be there just hanging out for 3 weeks versus being in the midst of everything. And as it turned out, most of what I expected I was going to be doing didn't happen because they had the Burmese elections, and then violence broke out and bombs started going off around me, and we started delivering food and supplies and things to and water to the refugees. So sometimes you get definitely taken out of your sphere of comfort unknowingly.
What I think is important for us to talk about is you have approached your service travel work in a very unconventional manner. You have sort of made it happen for yourself. You haven't signed up for any tours or done the volunteerism per se. You kind of did your research and lined up your connections. Will you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I think people travel very differently. And there's some people that want to take a tour and want to make sure everything, they know what's happening. And there's other people, men, I'd say probably the bulk of people from Telluride who travel just go. And just, you know, and there's people who are far more adventuresome than I am. That's all, it's difficult. If you've got 2 weeks to go travel somewhere, it's really difficult to set something up. And if that's the case, your other guest, I checked out her website and her program looked excellent.
Erin from Edge of
yes,
Seven.
Yes, yes. I just had a chance to glance at it and it looked excellent. So if you're someone who says, look, I've got 2 weeks off a year, I have 3 weeks off, and I want to go and I want to be on the beach for a week, but I'd like to volunteer, hers is a great program. It sounds like a great program. On the other hand, almost everywhere I've been, they need help. I mean, you could show up and say, where's the local orphanage? And walk in and say, you know, do you need some help? The problem that arises always is that it's hard for projects to integrate someone for a short period of time. It's sometimes more work for them than it's worth. And that's why all these organizations that set things up have to charge what they do, because they're setting up the infrastructure for you. My style of travel is to sort of know where I'm going, kind of show up, check out the place for a day or whatever, and then kind of decide whether I'm going to stay there or not. So I tend to freelance travel, at least to a certain extent. And again, not to the extent that many people in Telluride do. And that said, I didn't just go over there and show up in a town and do something. I did do my research and try and check things out. But what I found is, for example, in San Cliburi, that most of the volunteers there had gone on the web, and there is one orphanage home kind of place, and everybody taps into that. So everybody was a volunteer there. At least initially, it started that way. There were lots of other volunteer opportunities. It was just that they don't all have websites, and, you know, it was a problem. So it's difficult to sometimes to do that.
Before the interview, you had suggested that, you know, just put it out there. Go on Facebook or Twitter. Start chatting about places. Say, I'm looking to do some volunteer work in such and such a country or such and such a type of volunteer work, and just kind of make connections over the internet to find out about different
absolutely.
Places.
Absolutely. And especially, I mean, in Telluride, there's so many people that have traveled a lot and know people, know of organizations. I get a lot of my contacts through people here. So, yeah, throw it out on Facebook or throw it out and just say, you know, is there anybody that's been to whatever country, and do you know of any local opportunities? I've got some contacts. I know some people in Nepal who told me, if you ever have someone that wants to volunteer in Nepal, let me know. I met in Bhutan. There's locals here. Laura Kudo helped start a school in Nepal, I think with Kathy James, but I'm not sure. I have a contact in Laos who does, it's the Laos project that you can check out on the internet. So I have a lot of connections and other people do. Throw it out there. Give me a call. Get on Facebook. Just say, I'm interested in going to this country. Has anybody had any experience with it? And I think you'll get a lot of results.
Are you on Facebook, Sharon?
I am.
Okay, Sharon Shooter. And for those that don't know, should I add that you're our local judge here? And
sure, but then you can't tell them how long I'm away volunteering.
Okay. Sharon, thank you so much for being a guest on Travel Fun. And I will be blogging about this on my blog, bonjourcolorado.com. Take care and good luck with all your travels.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Sharon. Bye-bye.
Come fly with me, let's fly away.
If you can use some exotic booze. There's a bar in far Bombay.
Come on, fly with me. We'll float down in the blue.
Fly with me, float down to Peru.
In Llama Land, there's a one-man band, and he'll toot his flute for you.
Fly with me, we'll take off in the blue.
Once I get you up there.